Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on August 17th, 2019. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is from the 18th chapter of the Dhammapada, known as the Malavagga. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Today's talk is on the another talk from the Dhammapada on the 18th chapter, known as the Malavagga. And this chapter speaks to the immediacy of practicing the Dhamma and the immediate benefits, meaning that the benefits of Dhamma practice are not expected in the future as some kind of karmically induced reward for good behavior or proper worship or anything else. The Dhamma is about awakening in this moment, in this lifetime. And this is a very encouraging chapter as it relates to that. And it touches on so many different important themes of the Dhamma. But notice, next week we're going to finally start our study on Vipassana and insight into the three marks of existence, including impermanence. And in this chapter, and in a lot of suttas, the Buddha begins with a profound teaching on our own impermanence. And of course, this isn't to be morbid. It's to encourage us, to let us know that the end is near for every one of us at some point, and it might be in the next few minutes. So it helps prioritize our Dhamma practice, doesn't it? It doesn't mean that it should be the only thing we should do, or that we should take to it out of fear. But just understand that this wise and brilliant man said, this is the Dhamma. You have an opportunity to awaken in this lifetime. Now do it. The chapter begins, aged like a withered leaf, death awaits. It may not be the most pleasant nighttime reading, is it? But it gets right to the point. And so why not face it? If we have a human life, which we all do, we're here, we're living in this world, one aspect of a human life, and it's included in the Buddha's description of dukkha, is aging and death. If we're here, we are under a death sentence. That's not something that we should focus on or even take in any morbid way, but we should be mindful of it. So what do we want out of this life? Do we want the biggest pile of gold when we leave? Do we want some type of power? Do we want a specific relationship that we insist we need to be happy? Or do we want to understand ourselves in relation to the world and end all disappointment, all unsatisfactory experiences? That's what the Dhamma offers us, except we have to take to it. Often the Buddha would use this phrase, we take to it like our hair's on fire. Let's get to it. Aged like a withered leaf, death awaits. You are near your departure, yet you are unprepared for your journey. Be an island unto yourself, so says the wise sage. Another such an important statement that the Buddha says over and over again. In fact, he made this statement as one of the last things he ever said while still alive. Be an island unto yourself. What does it mean? It means that ultimately, Dhamma practice is an individual, personal experience. No one can bestow the benefits of the Dhamma except ourselves. It doesn't come from any outside source. It comes from direct experience of developing this simple and direct Dhamma. Engage in right effort and become wise. Right effort simply means holding in mind and practicing the entire Eightfold Path. Become rid of all impurities and become stainless. Isn't that a wonderful word to use for this? Of course, it's interpreted, but it explains and signifies the whole point of the Dhamma, to be stainless, to have not a stain of ignorance left that is provoking anything that would be cause conflict in our minds and in the world. Become rid of all impurities and become stainless. Enter the abode of the awakened ones. Life is fleeting and you are now at the end. I think the setting probably was, there was someone sick and dying. And there's quite a few suttas under the title of Gilana. We're going to touch on one of them during our study. But Gilana simply means sick. And I can think of six or seven offhand that relate to sickness in some way, and using that The Buddha's teaching that, okay, you're sick, you may be at the end, you're in great suffering, now's the time for Dhamma practice. Life is fleeting and you are now at the end. Death rules the ignorant. There is no rest along the way, yet you are unprepared for the journey. That line, that death rules the ignorant. The Buddha would call his Dhamma and the development of the Dhamma, developing the deathless state. And many, many people, misunderstanding the Dhamma, took that as the Buddha's teaching eternal life. In fact, there's some traditions that say once you awaken, poof, you just vanish from the world and you're living in this eternal Buddhist heaven. Of course, they forget the fact that the Buddha awakened and spent 45 more years trudging the planet. What the Buddha is referring to in the deathless state is a state that there's no longer the living death of ignorance. And why is that? Because when our minds are rooted in ignorance, we can only create a fabricated existence of ourselves in relation to the world, meaning a conditioned view that conditions the way we think about ourselves in relation to the world that isn't based in reality. It's based on fabrications. So if we're doing that and living in that fabricated realm, we're not really living our lives, are we? We may spend 100 years on this planet, but if we're stuck in ignorance, we are living the living death of ignorance. The Buddha is referring to the deathless state of an awakened human being. So let me go back to it again. Death rules the ignorant. There is no rest along the way, yet you are unprepared for your journey. Be an island unto yourself, so says the wise sage. Engage in right effort and become wise. Become rid of all impurities and become stainless. End the pain of birth and constant decay. That relates, again, directly in contradiction to what most of modern Buddhists and modern people believe, and it was common during the Buddha's time, that there's some value in a future rebirth. What the Buddha is saying, that any birth that's rooted in ignorance is prone to decay and prone to stress and suffering. And so the mind immediately wants to go to, what happens when I die then? What's going to become of me? Think about that for a moment. What is generating that thought? But clinging to a fabricated view of yourself. And in many, many suttas, there's a whole section on the website called Right Mindfulness and Dhamma Practice, something like Right Mindfulness and Dhamma Practice or Authentic Dhamma, where the Buddha says that over and over and over again. Don't be concerned about any future life or even the next moment unless your thinking is framed by the Eightfold Path, because then you will give birth to the deathless state of wisdom. Is that clear? So even though this came up with a student last night too, online, even though the Buddha referred to karma, he referred to it in a completely different way to use that general understanding of manipulating future births and future moments to put the focus on right now. So the true definition of karma, an explanation of karma within the framework of the Buddha's Dhamma, is karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional acts moderated by the present level of mindfulness. Excuse me. I can think about that while I take a sip. What that means is that if our minds are still unrestrained and still rooted in fabrication and still grasping after further fabrications to maintain its own view of itself, all that we're doing is continuing that flow that was set in motion by past wrong views. Is that clear? And so one can only expect to give birth to another moment rooted in that same ignorance, unless something comes along to interrupt that thinking and change that point of view, right? That's the Eightfold Path. That's the Dhamma. And so then in this present moment, with my mindfulness framed by the Eightfold Path, I'm inclining my mind towards reality, towards the cessation of ignorance, towards that deathless state, which simply means that for the first time, I'm actually living my life as my life unfolds. That's called being alive, isn't it? And how else can there be true human life, a true human experience, unless we're actually in our bodies and seeing what's occurring and unfolding from the point of view of reality, rather than a fabricated, this is how I want to see the world view. Clear?
Yes.
Remarkable teaching. And that's the seeing the world from that point of view is seeing the world from the point of view of a stainless mind. Moment by moment, one by one, a little at a time, meaning coming back into the present moment with the framework of the Eightfold Path. A little at a time, the wise Dhamma practitioner removes impurities, and I love the metaphor, the visual, just as a skilled smith removes dross from silver. You don't have to really know about metallurgy and making steel out of ore, but it's simply the same process that we go through internally of doing different things and heating the steel up and doing this and that and getting the impurities out of the ore to make it steel. We're doing the same thing with our minds. We're engaging in this effort, just to maintain the metaphor, to heat up our own impurities to the point where we can recognize them. Why? You know what a smith does as he's taken ore from an impure state to a pure state? He heats it up, it gets a crust on it, and he beats it with a hammer.
He forges it.
That's right.
And reforges it.
And we're doing the same thing. We're not beating ourselves over the head with a hammer, but it points out to the focus, the concentration that's required, that's part of the Eightfold Path, so that we can incorporate the entire Eightfold Path, the restrained mindfulness, to see what's occurring moment by moment, to see the impurities arise. Another word would be fetters.
Stains.
Thank you. Why? Not to pick at them, not to analyze them, not to figure out where they come from or blame anybody or the world or a political party or something going on around the globe. Why? So we can recognize that we fabricated this. We created it in our minds. And the wonderful thing about that, the most empowering thing of that understanding is if I created it, this is the Buddhist teaching on what actually constitutes a self. If I created it, only I can change it. And how do I do it? Through a way of recognizing what I've done. And something that provides me clear direction on how to act and think more skillfully this moment on. Not in the future. Not when I'm good enough. Not when I've studied long enough or come to enough classes. Right here, right now, is when Dhamma practice begins. And any of you that have benefit, and I think everyone, and I know you well enough, that you've benefited from this practice, that means that you're practicing it in the moment, the way it's intended, or there would be no benefit. The Buddha continues, rust devours its own base, just as misdeeds devour the mind of fools. That doesn't even need any commentary, does it? If we want to know why we've had difficulties at times, or maybe more or less constantly in our life, that's why. It's not because of what's happening to us, it's because of the way we think about what's happening to us. Neglect destroys the home. Sloppiness destroys destroys personal appearance. Mindlessness destroys the guard, meaning we're no longer able to practice wise restraint. Anything's coming in and we're fabricating an existence over that. Non-repetition destroys the Dhamma. So those of you that want to know why I keep saying the same thing over and over again, because I learned that from the Buddha.
He says mindlessness destroys the guard?
Yes, mindlessness destroyed the guard. And it is. It's that...
The guard or the garden?
Guard. G-U-A-R-D.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
And again, the Buddha would often describe a well-concentrated mind that has incorporated the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path as well-protected, implying that this is something we need to do to protect our minds. And just as we might not want to watch extremely violent movies just because we don't want to expose ourselves to that. I don't. I used to when I was a kid. The violent, the better. That's an act of protecting our minds right now, right here. Just a practical way. I don't want to look at these kind of things. But as we develop the Dhamma, we take that to much more subtle levels of recognizing anything that is causing conflict in my mind, I don't want to associate with it. Why? Because my intention is to develop, take control of my thinking, and develop a calm and peaceful mind, no matter what is occurring in the outside world or between my own ears. And this is a way to do it. And that's the whole point. Thank you for the question. Mindlessness destroys the guard. I can't do it without refined mindfulness, not just a generalized mindfulness. In fact, that line kind of points to the problem with modern mindfulness, which is often taught that you need to be mindful of everything. Well, that kind of leads to a subtle, frantic grasping after everything, doesn't it? What am I doing now? I better be mindful of looking at the computer. I better be mindful of looking at you. I better be mindful of driving. I better be mindful of thinking. I better be mindful of... Where does it end? It's just a constant mindless distraction using mindfulness as the framework for it. The Buddha taught a very specific application of mindfulness to develop the concentration that so that we can incorporate the entire Eightfold Path as the way that we're viewing the world, to go from wrong view to right view. Non-repetition destroys the Dhamma. Unchastity stains men and women. Miserliness stains the giver. Stains are indeed always evil things. A worse stain than these, all of those things that the Buddha just describes, a worse stain is a stain of ignorance. Destroy this one stain. This is the focus of the Dhamma. Don't worry about all these other stains and these maybe aspects of less than skillful behavior, because you're missing the point. If you're always addressing the results of ignorance, you're never getting to the point of ignorance, are you? Destroy this one thing. That's all the Dhamma asks of us. When I say it's simple and direct, that's what I mean. It's focused on this one single thing, even though that one single thing has now infiltrated just about every thought we may have, because our minds are not guarded. Stains are indeed always evil things. A worse stain than these is a stain of ignorance. Destroy this one stain and become stainless. Skip over some commentary. Easy it is for fools, stubborn as cows, backbiting, unrestrained, arrogant, and corrupt. Meaning, easy it is to just ignore their own ignorance because they're so caught up in their own conflict and just look out on the world. Difficult it is for the truly humble one who seeks the stainless to be free of entanglements, unassuming, pure, and wise. Excuse me. Notice the Buddha saying it's difficult. He's not saying it's impossible. He's saying that you need to engage in some effort. It's not something that's going to be given to you just because you decide that you're going to live some pure, chaste life. It doesn't work that way. It's an inside job. We develop this ourselves. Fools take lives. Utter lies. They steal. They take another spouse and are addicted to drink and drugs. They dig themselves up by the root here and now, meaning they don't leave themselves any footing in reality. Know this, friends. Evil is difficult to control. Do not let greed and wickedness bring you ongoing misery. Excuse me. So the Buddha is using some rather extreme examples of poor behavior, but that last line, do not let greed and wickedness bring you ongoing misery. Can you think of any time when you might describe yourself as miserable, that the underlying cause was because you wanted a situation in your life to be different than it is?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's not really the situation then that's causing the distress. It's the need for what's occurring to be different than it is. Correct? Everybody
yes.
Following me?
Yeah.
That's kind of the essence of the Buddha's Dhamma.
Yes and no. I mean, what if it's a physical thing?
I can answer that. No. Because I have a lot of physical pain. It no longer... I'm not saying I don't do anything about it. I do the things that I think are reasonable without looking for a miracle where I know one can be. I take care of myself. But I also understand at 63 years, almost 64, and the life I've lived and falling off of roofs and getting in car accidents and all that kind of thing, this is the result of it. That's all. I don't take it personal. My mind doesn't react to it. When a severe pain hits, I go, and the dog looks at me, and I take a breath and come back into my body. And honestly, I'm not trying to hold myself up as some miracle of the Dhamma. This is how it works.
Based on what you're saying, is it just practice with the jhana focus of recognizing and not letting that sensation, which will arise often if it's chronic,
mm-hmm.
to pass, or is it something that...
No, I don't think about it passing. I just, this is, if I did, and I mean, this is, you know, this is a rather recent occurrence with me, and I think I practiced the Dhamma as it's meant to, meaning within my body and what's occurring with me, and that has allowed me to not think, well, this is really awful, but I hope it passed, because that's, in that moment, my mind is conflicted about what's occurring right now, and it's not saying, and I don't do something, just using this word because it's common, I don't do something silly like embracing pain like people talk about you should do, and I don't breathe into my pain because that's impossible, that's another fabrication. I simply have learned to be present with my life as my life unfolds, and if it's pain, and right now there's no pain in my body. While I was meditating, my ankle was throbbing because it does that sometimes. And so it wasn't, well, I'm meditating, how can this happen now? How can I meditate with a, okay, there's pain, come back to my breath. Do you understand? So the Buddha's first statement of reality is dukkha occurs. Suffering, conflict, disappointment occurs. And he explains why. Birth, sickness, aging, and death are painful. Not getting, he continues, not getting what is desired is painful. Getting what is undesired is painful. He's simply describing human life, isn't he? But why make that so important? Because that's the essence of it. Because when dukkha occurs to a mind that's fabricated, it continues to fabricate away from anything that it finds disappointment. And that initial motivation away from disappointment is the initial motivation away from living your life as life occurs. How do we know it? Because that's what life is. So rather than take something as physical pain or mental pain personally and need it to be different, or the external pain of the things that occur in the world and need that to be different, maybe a different ruler in this country as opposed to that country, or a different outcome to whatever the current social climate is that we're worried about, I can be at peace with all of that. It doesn't mean that I don't recognize the things that are painful and hurtful in the world and towards people. In fact, it means just the opposite. I can stay present with it because this is part of life. And again, just it's such a great question, Tim. Thank you. And this is not reflecting on you, but the underlying thought that brought that up in your mind is what brings it up in everybody's mind. We think that we're supposed to run away from dukkha. It's ingrained. And so the thought was, well, what happens when dukkha arises? What happens when you feel pain? The answer is you apply the Dhamma. Just like I would in any other situation.
Yeah, so, I mean, it sounds great, but, you know, when, and again, I'm just going through my process.
Please.
You know, I don't want to interrupt this.
No, this is important.
But I had to stop my Dhamma practice last year because it was just nonstop, the physical aspect of it.
Oh, the pain.
Yeah, so, you know, it's one thing to be concerned about the global events. You can shut your TV off. You know, you can shut your door.
Mm-hmm.
But when there's something like what you experience and others experience, where it's always mm-hmm. there, nonstop. I made the analogy a couple of weeks ago, and I mean that because I know it's not. You know, it's I know it's a fabrication, but it's there.
No. Wait, not to cut you off. The pain is real. The pain isn't fabricated. It's our response,
the response
that is rooted in ignorance. And so it's a fabricated response.
But it wears you down.
Well, wait. But again, not only that's, interrupt, it wears you down because of the reaction to it.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'll let you continue, but just to make those points.
Well, no, that's really it. And so for me, you know, it's all about prior. You know, I think there's a prioritization that happens where it's
yep.
You know, it's hard for me to get involved with global what's going on in another country when, you know, I feel like there's a knife in my back.
Yeah, so you don't need to be involved in the outside world anyway.
Right.
That's not part and parcel of Dhamma practice. Or even part and parcel of having chronic pain.
But I find that I guess my question to you and to the Dhamma class is, through proper through right meditation, you know, I feel that when I am practicing the meditation properly, it helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then when anything that Eightfold Path is swayed in a negative way, in an extreme way, it just comes back like a force.
I don't understand that last.
Well, you start spiraling. You start getting wrong views.
Because just to use the word, when the negative aspects of the Eightfold Path are apparent.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So that's when I was reading the sutta, you know, it's a very generalized statement, of course, but there is that extreme. I know I hate to use the word extreme, but and I think you can agree, you know, physical pain can be very extreme. I mean, I always think about that Buddhist monk during the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
I know, but
he had nothing to do with Buddhism.
I know he didn't, but he just sat there.
I know, but Tim, I'm not. Yeah. That wasn't a frivolous. It wasn't a frivolous comment. He wasn't a Buddhist. That's not an example of Buddhist practice at all. There's nothing related to the Buddhist teaching that would tell someone to immolate themselves for any reason.
I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about not reacting to that pain. Of being on fire.
I saw that video. It sure looked to me like he was reacting to it, but.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm.
You get.
I'm,
I mean, you
I'm
get.
I could be.
Well, well yeah, we're getting into something that we don't need to get into.
Okay.
Whether he reacted, no, it's whether he reacted to it or not. Let me say it this way, I didn't notice what I noticed. It's miraculous that he was able to sit there and burn himself to death without flinching at all. Do you think you could do it?
No.
So, again, I'm not trying to be flippant. So my point again, not to be flippant with you.
Okay.
Why even think about it?
I agree.
Well, again, so that's an example of a distracted mind,
yes,
clinging to something to further. And again, look at the it's generated. And this is not. This is what happens to everyone, Tim. We cling ourselves to certain situations to fabricate further doubt against reality, not even against the Dhamma. So you're kind of using those examples as to why this might not work. And you said something earlier about the pain became so difficult that you couldn't continue with Dhamma practice. And my question is, no matter how much pain you have in your body, you're not able to continue to think and integrate the Eightfold Path and meditate maybe even just for a few minutes at a time.
That's why I came back, and that's why I started up again. Because I saw myself when I stopped, things got not better at all. Of course, the Dhamma practice is very helpful. I was responding to the sutta, and I didn't need to go off track. I apologize.
No, it's just so important. Don't apologize for it, Tim. You're helping everyone with this, including me.
I guess what I'm saying is that there are distractions in life that I feel that are fairly simple to understand and be free of. And then there are those that are, I find, more challenging.
Oh, yeah. That's what the Buddha's talking about that here, too. It's difficult.
Yeah.
It's difficult. Especially when you think about the essence of the Dhamma is to, within a mind that is rooted in ignorance, to resolve ignorance. That's the difficult part. If I could take an awakened mind, there'd be no difficulty, would there? But I can't do that. It has to happen in the same mind that's ignorant. That's the brilliance of the Siddhartha Gautama. He's the first one that figured out there's nothing outside that can change my insides. Nothing. But my insides might insist that there be something outside that can fix me because I don't want to take responsibility for it. So I'll attach myself and create all these magical, mystical scenarios for my own salvation that allows me to live my life without having to deal with the main problem of my own thinking. And any other Dhamma that would allow for even a shred of speculative, fabricated thinking would be cruel. coming from the point of view of a man that understood the cruelty and the pain of fabricated living. But it is that strict dividing line between Four Noble Truths, between reality and the way we want reality to be, that is so difficult for the world to overcome, not just Dhamma practitioners. You know, a mind that's rooted in ignorance, if it was inclined towards awakening naturally, we would have done so.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't need an individual human being to say, listen, folks, it's your thinking that's wrong. It's not because I don't have enough gods or devas or magical or mystical beliefs stuck in my head. It's because I don't know how to think. Because I don't know how to think in relation to what's occurring. That's all that the Dhamma is. And this, the next 16 weeks, 32 class, focuses specifically on how to see this correctly. The three marks of existence, the impermanence of all things, the misunderstanding of self, anatta, and the resulting suffering. And what you did, thank you so much, Tim, for what you brought up, because that is a perfect description of it. The conflict and the doubt in our own minds. And we'll always try to find scenarios where, well, here's a situation where this can't possibly work. What did you just do? You just convince yourself to turn away from this. And that's fine. Nobody has to do this at all. Or you can. It's just that way. There's nobody, even I would never tell you, you have to take up the Dhamma. If you came to me with some issues in your life, I'd ask you to try it. But thank you, Tim. Let me just continue. Know this, friends. Evil is difficult to control. Do not let greed and wickedness bring you ongoing misery. People respond to worldly events based on their mindfulness, meaning what they're holding in mind, not a mindfulness practice. Whatever we're holding in mind is going to determine our life experience. Those upset by others' fortune cannot develop concentration, and that's just obvious, isn't it? If my mind is so rooted in greed and miserliness, I'm always going to be thinking about all the great things that everybody else has and I don't. How can you develop concentration thinking like that? It's just, the point I'm making, it's just another practical teaching from someone who, even during his time, everything was magical and mystical and otherworldly and influenced by disincarnate beings and all these beliefs. The Buddha says it's because of improper mindfulness, because we're holding in mind something that is unskillful. Those whose defilements have been completely destroyed will develop concentration. So again, it's a synergistic path, isn't it? It's not just a concentration path. It's not just meditation. Why is it not just meditation? Because we need a framework for understanding our behavior. I remember saying this quite a few years ago, and I haven't said it recently, I don't think, that if we're not reining in our behavior through being mindful of right speech, right action, and right livelihood, our minds will simply be too conflicted to ever develop useful concentration. And so that's why that's part of, it's not because the Buddha is teaching morality in a religious sense or ethics in a religious sense, because if we're not moral and ethical people, we're gonna get punished. He teaches morals and ethics so that our minds remain stainless, remain pure. We can't expect to continue to act in a hurtful way and expect it not to impact the way we think. Those upset by others' fortune cannot develop concentration. Those whose discontent has been destroyed completely will develop concentration. You know, I said that twice. Nothing burns hotter than lust. Nothing grips harder than hatred. Nothing entangles like delusion. Nothing continues ignorance like craving. Think about each one of those words and how you felt when you were involved in any of these. This one, nothing entangles like delusion. Again, I ask you all to go back into a time in your life when you were just simply confused about what was going on in the world and you were stuck in a situation that you didn't think you can get out of. Isn't that confused by your own entanglements? And if your entanglements weren't there, if you weren't clinging to these aspects of your life, there'd be no conflict. The situation would likely still be there, wouldn't it? But you would not be reacting to it. And it's the same with pain in your body.
And especially if you're misunderstanding the situation.
Yeah, so yeah.
In your delusion, you're doing exactly the wrong things to get out of it.
Yep, you're into blaming yourself or others or societal systems or the weather, you know, whatever it is. And you're, as soon as you do that, you're out of your mind because you're out of your body. You're into a speculative existence. How you think, how you want something to be. Excuse me. Does everybody see the construct of what I want things to be as a fabrication? Even if it's real. I mean, it's an honest statement. I want world peace. But to insist on world peace is a fabrication, isn't it? Why? Because it isn't. So I could be inclined towards compassionate and sympathetic human values without losing my mind over dukkha. Why? Because I understand living in the world, dukkha occurs. And there's nothing ever personal about it. Ever. Even if I'm acting out in a way that is hurtful and I'm responsible for it, it's not personal because I'm acting from an ignorant view of who I am, or I wouldn't act that way in the first place. An awakened human being is completely incapable of harming another human being. Why? Because it's not within them. It's simply not within them. That's a true peaceful sage, isn't it? Nothing entangles like delusion. Nothing continues ignorance like craving, including, and most importantly, wanting things to be different than they are. Others' faults are obvious. One's own faults are difficult to see. I've noticed that's so true about everyone, except me.
That's like the root of idle chatter right there.
It is.
As everybody's noticing everything but themselves.
Yep. Yeah. And one of the primary aspects of right speech is gossip, is not to do it,
it's
to not do it.
The ultimate distraction.
Yeah. And that's almost a common conversation, isn't it? Talking about others. And even talking about, to me, gossip is even talking about situations that I have no control over. It's still kind of the same thing, making them wrong. I don't get too deep into it. The fool ignores their own faults and can only see the faults of others. Always seeking others. I gotta say it. Look at the political rhetoric, and that's all that it is. Is one side saying, "Look at the wrong, what's wrong with them," and the other, and look at, and it's getting nowhere, isn't it? And it's simply, and it is. It's just such a good example of how a conflicted mind keeps increasing the conflict in the world, because that's just what's happening, isn't it? It's just a good example. I'm not going to get into politics. Always seeking others' faults. The fool's defilements grow. While I'm so worried about how wrong everything is, everybody else is and the world is, my defilements are growing. Because that's an aspect of greed, isn't it? And it's an aspect of aversion, too. They are far from cessation. There is no hidden path or other understanding. This flies into all that ignorant views that there's something magical or mystical or hidden about any of this. There is no hidden path or other understanding. Fools delight in the things of the world. And by the way, all those fabricated, speculated beliefs are not something heavenly, meaning otherworldly. They're fabricated in this world. Even though the reference is otherworldly, they're part of the world. They're part of the social lexicon that we've all developed to deal with dukkha in a very ineffective way. Is that clear? It's not like we're, as Dhamma practitioners, we're ignoring something. That'd just be more ignorance. We're recognizing the invalidity of the belief system that creates it, the fallacy of it, the stain of it. Wise Dhamma practitioners are free of worldly entanglements. There is no hidden path other than understanding. All fabrications are impermanent. awakened minds are stable. What a wonderful way to finish it, isn't it? Awakened minds are stable. Have any of you ever experienced an unstable mind?
Yes.
Oh, never. Everybody else's, but not mine. Yeah.
Well, I remember even as a kid, like 15, 16, 17 years old, and I didn't have the framework to see it this way, but I don't even know if the right word is shocked, but I was concerned about how unstable my mind was, how it was jumping from this thought to that thought and reacting to these thoughts. I didn't understand why. I thought this is just how human beings live their lives, which is true. It's how most human beings live their lives. And it wasn't until I came to the Buddha's Dhamma that I realized I can regain control of my mind. I can think what I want to think whenever I want to think it. Even when there's pain in my body, in my mind, or out in the world. It is remarkable. Let's go around the room. Kevin, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. Good morning. How are you, John?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
You know, there's a lot in this sutta, obviously, but a couple things stood out. I mean, being an island unto yourself, I think this type of teaching or this sutta, there's something in that. I mean, keep rereading this because there's so much in there, and spend some time with yourself with this and really see what's coming out of it. I think there's something to that. And I also think that I like those metallurgy metaphors because, you know, when he says what we were talking about earlier, non-repetition destroys the Dhamma, and I can, you know, relate to that specifically at the moment. My practice has sort of faded a little bit, but that's sort of that metaphor of reforging metal to make it harder and sharper and stronger to have the restraint to cut through this veil of ignorance. Because if you think of a veil as very thin, you know, this is very, very, very fine things, and with a distracted mind, there's just no way you're ever going to see it. You're just going to be in reaction to reaction to reaction to reaction, which is what normal life to an unawakened mind will feel like. So that's why that non-repetition part really stuck out to me. We really have to, you know, guard, as we're saying, guard our senses, have that concentrated mind to practice restraint. And if we're in reaction, you've often said then there's ignorance present. We're caught up in something that, you know, we need to come back to what's occurring, whether it's pain, you know, whether it's frustration, joy, whatever it is, we've got to just really keep reforging to be strong enough. So, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, and that idea of repetition relates to hearing the Dhamma and practicing the Dhamma, and practicing the Dhamma in the moment. The repetition of being mindful of what's occurring and practicing restraint over and over. It's not just when big events happen and catch our attention. It really is an essence of a well-concentrated mind to be able to practice that wise restraint moment by moment, stay out of being entangled in the world that way. Thank you. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning, John. I reading the sutra at home, I really like the expression to have a stainless mind. And when you ever catch yourself having conflict in your mind, it's just a very clear expression that you're carrying a stain from the past, from the present, from the past or from the future into the right now, right at this present time. You're carrying a stain in your mind.
Yep.
And I think that's just a wonderful expression of clearing your mind up and sorting out what's real in life, what's really going on, and what's the stain that you're carrying from past or the future into this moment. And I just think that's a very good expression. And what helps me often when I get going down the wrong road and down an illusion road and all that sort of stuff is that I can always reflect back to one practice I had with Matt in Qigong, and he explained about the stars and the solar system, blah, 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 blah. And it got right down to when we were like one-cell organisms crawling out the water and, the whole evolution thing. When he described it like that, you could see that there was no point in time when you could add an I. You were just an organism, and we're just more complex organisms right now. There isn't really a point in time when you could say, okay, now we've become people and we've become, this fabrication that we have in our minds.
Yep.
There isn't a point in time. It happens, but it's a fabrication.
Yeah.
To think that. And that often you can see that from that you can see that with the six properties. We are just the six properties.
Yeah.
And sometimes when I get caught up in my illusions, I can just say, hey, wait a minute, If I'm thinking this, I'm not right now. I'm not believing. I am just the six properties, and that can like just ground me a little bit and stop me going and building up into, more of an illusion and more of a fabrication, etc. I can just like check it all back, because I, as I say, from all your teaching, and also I'm not disregarding you, obviously, but sometimes with all you teach and then you add Matt to it as well, it like clarifies it. You can just see it from another angle.
Yep.
Obviously, it's the combined teachings. It's you and Matt together. But as I say, so that's sort of like just at the end of the day, I believe I do believe I'm the six. I'm only six properties, and that just helps. Around me in my difficult times. So, thank you.
Thank you. What a great explanation of practicing Dhamma at the point of contact, and reminding yourself, this is not me. This is not mine. I'm just these six properties, and that's all we can ever be. Mm-hmm. Everything else that we create about ourselves past those six properties is in our own minds, isn't it? Including the physical things that we acquire. How do we know it? Because where are those things when you're gone? I mean, really. And the idea of evolution is so interesting because we take the fabrications that have developed within our evolutionary cycle as something outside of evolution, meaning that they were these ideas of magical, mystical realms as reality. But where did they came from? We thought them up. Nobody's ever been there. So, In a way, we've created an evolutionary fallacy that the Buddha realized. And as evolution continues, I don't want to get too scientific. As evolution has continued, we've only contributed to the fabrication. That doesn't mean that evolutionary terms, we haven't accomplished anything. We have. We've done incredible things, even in my lifetime. I mean, just things like going to the moon, etc. But all the great technological advances. But we haven't resolved any real issues. We haven't never resolved the issue of ignorance. Why? Because we're more concerned about external acquisitions and maybe even external intellectual knowledge than resolving the issue of ignorance first. But we can still do it within all that. But that's it. I mean, ignorance has evolved as humans have evolved, hasn't it? Good morning.
It's great to be here. And I think that the system out there is geared to get us to click back to the disillusionments and the fabrications, because that's how they keep us in line and keep us unable to go within. And so, you watch the news and no matter how much you've meditated that day, you can almost feel yourself being drawn into that, and that's what they want. whatever they may be. But just the system, the way the world is evolved, that's the best way to keep us off our feet and off our cushion and off balance, and they can better manipulate.
Yeah. Thank you. We've created these systems too, the social sharing networks, the so-called media, one person likes to call it fake news, actually both sides. But we've created those systems. Whether they're fake or not, I think a lot of times they are, but that's not anything new either. You know, it isn't. So why should those systems be any different? Why wouldn't we have created systems that work to continue our own ignorance? We did, and it worked well. We shouldn't be surprised at it, or even too terribly upset that that's what occurs. Mm-hmm. Hello, Rob.
Yeah, this whole idea of
Mind
evolution, but there's this aspect where our disappointment and our frustration has been part of the driving force in our evolution.
Yep.
So we're almost working against evolution here in the Dharma practice.
Against evolutionary ignorance, yeah.
Uh-huh. We're trying to work against this driving force of evolution. Yeah. We're finally starting to see that this disappointment and frustration is what's causing us harm.
Yeah. It is. And that is all rooted in the three defilements. Mind things will be different. Thank you. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Al. Yes, I spoke enough.
You did. You brought a lot. Thank you. Brett, good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for the teaching. It was
my pleasure.
Really good. I'm glad to be here. I just came back from vacation, and it was, I felt like it was kind of a monument. You know, in a way, it was a monumental stinger, you know. But I went over Europe, and I was over, you know, and it was, you know, far away from home, and, you know, I mean, shit, you know, I feel like it's a chapter turning in my page, turning in my life, and, you know, so it was a challenge to be over there and not to attach myself to the things that came up and stuff like that. And I was on an island, so I had the sun and the moon, the sun in front of me and the mountains behind me, and that kept me from, like, freaking out, just being able to be in my own body, without, you know, the distractions of what it's like to be here. And then coming back, you know, I was laying in bed this morning, and, you know, I was just praying and hoping that, you know, that I could be able to view myself without the, you know, the distraction or all the attachments. What would it be like without all these attachments and the, you know, thoughts? And can I just, you know, what's up here? So it was really, you know, it helped. This teaching helped a lot because it was exactly what I needed to hear.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
John, very well.
Good.
Great to be here. It's a great teaching. It's really, really deep.
Yeah.
And it starts with death. Death is what it all ends with. And, you know, it just harkens back to Buddha's, what his last statement, that death is ever present. Seek diligently for your own enlightenment.
Yeah.
And that's what we're all doing, I think, and what we need to keep doing.
Thank you. I mean, that encouragement, you know, urgent encouragement is prevalent throughout the Dhamma too. I mean, Bahia's teaching, but so many others. You know, time is short. Take to it now. And again, if the culmination of the Dhamma is unwavering peace and calm, why put it off? Good morning, Becky.
Good morning, John. I really like the sutta because I really like the forging metaphor, and what led up to that metaphor, where it said little by little, a little bit at a time. And for me personally, that really struck a chord, because when I first started studying the Dhamma, I was sort of overwhelmed by how wonderful it was. I had these sort of experiences where I would have an auspicious day, and I just, you know, you get that sort of feeling if you're just going, oh, like that. And then as you go on, you realize that you have to keep working for that to be, for, to have that calm and peaceful mind, which is really, I think, what I'm describing, is not the point, really. It's, the point is to accept whatever's happening. But then you realize that you just, you have to continue the effort in order to have that peaceful and mindfulness to accept whatever's happening. And when you are able to accept whatever's happening, that's when an even deeper, I don't know what to call it, a deeper calm, a more, you just feel like you've gone to another level, sort of, but
yeah.
It's not something that happens quickly. You have to keep forging, you have to keep pounding. And it's very important to realize that that's little by little. And when I read that last night, I thought, wow, it's true. It's little by little.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's a journey.
Isn't it? It's never lost on me how powerful these words still are, 2,600 years later. I mean, this is a translation, and the translation, you know, it's my own interpretation within the framework of what the Buddha intended. And I think that it's well-founded, and it's just remarkable in its simplicity when you get down to it,
mm-hmm.
and what it addresses. It doesn't address anything. There's nothing addressed in the Dhamma that we can't experience directly. Nothing. There's nothing to take us out of our body. It really is remarkable, and we're fortunate. Something I was going to say. Oh, our retreat's coming up quickly. If you're going, and you know you're going, please register as soon as you can. And next week we're going to be starting our 16-week, 32-class study of Vipassana, meaning introspective insight in the context of the Buddhist Dhamma. It doesn't refer to the Vipassana movement or a hybrid meditation method. And over the course of these 32 classes, we're going to look at, in a very well-structured way, these things that we talk about, these three marks of existence. And what does it really mean to gain insight into them? How do they come up? How do they bubble up in our lives, and when to take notice of them? I think it's going to be a really remarkable series of classes. So 16-week, 32 classes means the classes won't be repeated. And so I encourage it. I know that many of you are busy. If you can come twice a week or do that. But at the very least, I would ask you to try to catch up on the classes that you don't come to by listening to them or watching them. You'll gain a lot of benefit by just coming once a week and missing half the classes. And the reason why I'm saying that is, don't be discouraged if you just don't have the time to do it, but you don't want to miss anything.
Is the Vipassana classes and the sequence that you're giving them in part of the Dhammapada?
No.
Okay,
no,
this is basically you're putting together the...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Initially, it started after the retreat, where I wanted to spend a few weeks just looking at dukkha and what does that really mean to experience dukkha at the point of contact. And as I started looking at that, I realized, well, you can't really address dukkha in that way unless you're addressing the three marks of existence. Mm-hmm. And as I started looking at that, I realized that not just to talk about that, but to put the three marks in the context of the suttas that relate directly to them. So we're going to study some of the suttas that we've looked at over and over again, like Dependent Origination, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, a few of the other ones, Satipatthana Sutta, Anapanasati Sutta. They're all going to be part of this study. But we're going to look at them and review them with that specific mindfulness. Where is this sutta teaching us? What is it teaching us about these three marks of existence? Because every sutta really is designed to do that, to get us to recognize this.
So that's where the title of the Pasana comes from.
Yep. And I've also changed the reference to meditation from Shamatha Vipassana to Jhana.
Mm-hmm.
And has anybody been to the website or listened to the... What do you find that in any way distracting or off-putting? Or is
No
big deal?
It's easier to say.
Doesn't really... Yeah, it does. And it relates well to your teacher, Jhana. Jhana Haspel. I think we should end on that note. We'll finish with metta as we always do.
I can get it up.
So again, find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.